Today is June 5th, 2017. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am sitting here on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, speaking with Jenny Foley. Jenny, thank you so much. Hey, today we're doing our interview via FaceTime, and hopefully it all goes well. Thank you, Jenny, for giving us this time today to talk about your amazing story and the impact you've had for Mill Valley and for cities and towns all over the United States. First, I'd just like to introduce you, Jenny. You grew up here in Mill Valley, and you've gone on to adulthood. We're going to be talking about your story in Mill Valley here as a child. But you've grown up since then, and you are a visual effects producer in the film industry, correct?
That is correct.
And you've been a film executive.
Yes, I've spent many years as a film executive as well.
And but your impact on the world at large was felt as far back as childhood, and that's what I'm so excited to be able to talk about today, because you are truly a Little League pioneer.
Oh, thanks, Deborah. I'm excited to be here and talking about it.
Okay, so let us go back in time to the 70s. You're living in Mill Valley, and you're here with your mother. And even before then, you have relatives. Let's start with them, shall we? Let's talk about your grandparents. Just a little background information about your family, if you would.
Sure. On my mother's side, I'm not sure which generation, San Franciscan, I'm probably fifth or sixth, something like that. And on my father's side, my great-great-grandparents came over and settled in San Francisco from Sweden right before the 1906 earthquake. So that scared them a bit, and they took off to Canada for a little bit. But then my great-grandmother came back. So everybody's from San Francisco. I was born in San Francisco in 1962, and we lived there for 9 years. And so in 1971, my mom was looking, I think, for more of a suburb type of lifestyle, so we moved over to Mill Valley.
And you said you were sixth generation in San Francisco?
I know that I'm one, two, third generation on my father's side, and I don't even know how far back it goes on my mother's side, but it goes back farther than that.
Oh my, let us disconnect this phone.
Hello?
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So, would you please be so kind as to give me the names of your grandparents?
Sure. When my great-great-grandparents came from Sweden, their last name was Holmstrom, and when they hit Ellis Island, they said, "That's too confusing, you're home, you're Strom." So he was Eric Strom, and his wife is, her name is escaping me now. Mm-hmm. Ruth Foley was their daughter and my great-grandmother and kind of my person. We all have our person, and Grandma Ruth was definitely my person. On my mom's side, I had Betty Briggs, and my mom was Donna Lyons. That was her married name. She got married probably in Mill Valley, probably when I was about 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was Mike Foley, but he died when I was quite young.
Quite young, really. Before the whole thing with the Little League came down?
Yes, he was one of the infamous jumpers from the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, well, let us go back then to the time that you came to Mill Valley, and tell me a little bit about your life in Mill Valley, if you can.
Sure. So we moved to Mill Valley when I was nine, and I went to Marin Terrace School for fourth and fifth grade, and it was a great time. It was a fantastic neighborhood. There was lots of kids. We ran in a pack, They were really great times. It was kind of Mayberry, I think, at that time in Mill Valley.
And Marin Terrace School was, because we don't have Marin Terrace now.
That's right.
Where was it located?
It was up at, we lived on Loring, and it was kind of that 5 points just up behind town.
Mm.
So, if you weaved up Homestead and went up there, it was just up above Tam High School.
Mm-hmm. And did you move here after your father's death?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he died when I was two.
Oh,
so
two. I see.
I have no memory of him.
Okay. So you're living in Mill Valley, and you're having this idyllic childhood from what you describe, and you have an interest in sports.
I do. Well, part of what we would do is when we would get together is we would go up to Marin Terrace, because in those days they didn't lock the schools up when school was out. So you had access to the fields, and we'd go up and we'd play baseball, and we'd play all sorts of different things up there in the neighborhood with the neighborhood kids. There was probably a good 12 of us at that time,
mm-hmm.
all in the same age range.
Do you remember the names of your friends?
I remember the Rockwells, Connie and Wendy and Jeff. Their house was kind of the clubhouse for the neighborhood kids, probably much to the dismay of the parents sometimes. And Paul and Keith and the Kelloggs, who they were a huge clan that lived up above Marin Terrace. I think they had four or five kids. Lori was my friend, Lori Kellogg. We're still friends on Facebook today.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are some of the kids that we played with. The Walshes, Tommy and Debbie. It was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember any favorite teachers from Marin Terrace School?
I loved my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Heaton. But she did betray me at one point. My mom used to make me wear a dress once a week to school, and she had made the dress. We didn't have a lot of money, so she would make some of my clothes. So she would put me in what I thought was a hideous dress and send me to school. So I would take my jeans, and I'd throw them out my bedroom window into the bushes, and I'd leave it in my dress and grab my jeans, and I'd tuck it in, and I'd go to school. And apparently Miss Heaton ratted me out. She told my that I was wearing pants on dress day.
There was, so now, was there a dress code for your school?
My mother, you know, I was quite a tomboy when I was a kid. My mm-hmm. mom just wanted me to wear a dress once a week. And I just didn't want to do it.
Uh-huh. And so your teacher's aware of this arrangement.
Well, it probably didn't look great. I mean, the dress probably didn't tuck in nicely to the pants. The 9-year-old me thinks that it was perfectly passable, but I can imagine that wasn't the case.
Jenny, that's funny. So tell me about that time. That now it's Little League season and you've got to go sign up. Tell us all the story about what happened.
I really wanted to play Little League. You know, at school, I could play with the boys and after school hours, but I don't remember it being co-ed. You know, during PE, I remember them breaking off the girls and the boys. And the girls, you know, they wanted to play horsies in the field, and the two popular girls, I don't remember their names, Erin and something else, they would always be like the riders, and all the girls would trot around the field, and it just didn't seem fun to me. When we did get to play softball with the girls, they would be, you know, they were very disinterested in that, and they wanted to pick flowers and make little daisy chains in the field, and it was very frustrating for me as somebody who wanted to play seriously, and I've always been competitive. So I would play with the boys as much as I could, and especially after school. I used to go down to Boyle Park a lot. I think, you know, 9 seems young. My time reference isn't, I don't know the exact age that I was, but, you know, as I said, Mill Valley was a little bit like Mayberry back then. And I would ride my bike to Boyle Park, which was probably 4 miles, 5 miles, something like that, and play in pickup games down there. So when it came time for Little League, it seemed only natural that I should be able to go and I should be able to play. So I decided that I would go ahead and try and sign up. And I had long hair at the time. I put it up in a ponytail up into my hat, and I went down and I thought I would just see what happened. And they were asking everybody for a birth certificate. And obviously my birth certificate was going to tell them I was a girl. So I left in disgust.
So where did you go? Was it on the baseball grounds? I mean, when you went to go sign up, where did you go sign up?
I remember it, and I don't know. I mean, it's a long time ago, but I remember it as being tables literally right at Boyle Park. I don't know if that's true or not,
mm-hmm.
but it seems to me like literally they set up 8-foot tables, and there were, you know, parents manning the station there, and you went and you signed up.
So,
and I was by myself. I was not, you know, I think a lot of the kids were probably with their parents.
Did you tell your mom you're going to do this?
I don't remember. I may have. And, you know, I was given a lot of freedom when I was a child. As long as I was home by dark or by dinner, we lived in a very safe place, and it was a different time. So whether she knew or not, I don't know. She wouldn't have discouraged it if she knew. She probably would have said, okay, that's great, hon. Have fun. See you for dinner.
What's your mom's name again?
Her name's Donna.
Donna. And so are you an only child?
I was an only child then. My mother remarried. Steve Lyons when, like I said, probably in 1974, and I have a brother, Sky Lyons, from that marriage.
Okay, so but basically at that time you were on your own.
Yes.
An independent spirit roaming about.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. So you see that you realize at that time that you're not going to be able to sign up because it's you know that they're going to see you're a girl. Did you really think in your mind that you might be able to pass?
Well, it wasn't like I was going to pretend to be a boy the whole season. I don't think I realized that it was such a hard and fast rule that girls just couldn't play. I guess I thought if I just go and it's kind of don't ask, don't tell, and you know, they maybe wouldn't notice, and then I'd sign up and they'd see how good I was and I'd be on the team and it would all be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's logical.
For a 10-year-old, it's very logical.
So you go home in disgust, then what?
So I'm upset. And so I went home and I was very upset about it because they wouldn't let me play. And no child wants to be excluded and not be able to play. So I decided I was gonna write a letter to President Nixon about this, letting him know how wrong it was and how unfair it was and that I should be able to play baseball. And I remember sitting at our kitchen table with my dad, Steve, my stepdad, Steve, and he was kind of looking over my shoulder and helping me write it. And I think it was on a piece of, 8.5 by 11 ruled paper using a pencil. And I addressed it to President Nixon, the White House, Washington, D.C., and it got mailed off, and that was that.
But you never really actually did somebody actually say to you, no, Jenny? You just could surmise this on your own. Which...
honestly, I don't have a clear memory of whether I pushed it and said. I was told the girls can't play. I was probably very obviously a girl when I was trying to sign up, and I would guess that they made it very clear that there are no girls allowed in Little
League. You got as far as you actually signed up all to the point where they asked for your birth certificate?
Yes.
Oh, so you'd actually filled out the forms and...
I would imagine so.
Yeah.
Or I might have walked up to the table and they might have immediately said, we're going to need to see your birth certificate before we give you the forms.
Okay, so you write a letter and you mail it to President Nixon.
Mm-hmm. So a few months went by and, I didn't think too much about it. I wasn't going to be able to play Little League. I would still go down and spend a lot of time at the park. Watching was second best to playing, a distant second, mind you. And about 3 months later, I got a letter from a gentleman who was running the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And he said that the president had asked him to respond to my letter and that they were preparing guidelines to handle this type of discrimination. I'm sure that it was all based on Title IX that had been recently passed. So that was that. Just we're preparing guidelines to handle this type of discrimination. A friend of mine's mom, my friend Paul Shea, his mom, whose name I can't remember now, worked for the Pacific Sun the Mill Valley Record at the time. And so she knew that I had gotten the letter back and she thought it would be a very interesting story. So the Mill Valley Record did a front page article on it about my trying to play baseball, Little League, not being able to, writing the president and getting a response. From that front page article in the Mill Valley Record, the Chronicle and Examiner both picked up on it and they did interviews. And then the whole story sort of started taking on a life of its own and picking up momentum.
So just for those that are listening that may not be aware of the Title IX, I'm going to read it out loud so we can understand that this is the premise in which you're able to continue on in this effort to include girls into baseball. And in 1972, the U.S. Department of Education enforces Title IX, which stated that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. So this is the premise of which you're able to launch your resistance to the exclusion of women in the sports.
Right.
So you've got some public notoriety. You're mm-hmm. 10 years old here, right?
That's right. 10 or 11.
10 or 11.
10 years old. Yeah, 10.
Yes. So How was that for you? How was it suddenly to become in the center of focus, involved in this legal skirmish?
Initially, I think that I was happy. I was hopeful. I thought, now they're going to let me play. People are taking notice. And it wasn't long after the Chronicle and Examiner stories that NOW, National Organization for Women, which was, you know, just kind of coming into its own, and it had a Marin chapter that had just been newly formed, and Lee Hunt was the president. Mm-hmm. She contacted my mother and said, you know, we think this is something that we would like to support you on and you know, see what we can do. And so my mother and I guess we talked about it and we thought, yes, let's do that.
How was your mother from the beginning with this? Was she, how did she respond when you came home? I mean, she must have seen that you were upset that day when you came home.
Yeah. My mother was always supportive. I was kind of a precocious child, and I kind of did things my own way. And so I think that she had learned to be supportive of me in whatever crazy endeavors I seemed to be taking on. So she was always very supportive. I never remember anybody saying in my family, Jenny, you should just let this go. You know, Little League's for boys, just let it go. I only remember my stepfather, Steve, sitting at the table with me, helping me write the letter, and, you know, and my parents being there for town halls, city council meetings, things like that.
So let's talk about the town hall and city council meetings. We had a first Wednesday presentation at the library that put on, hosted by the Mill Valley Historical Society. We mm-hmm. had with us Lee Hunt, the attorney mm-hmm. who contacted you, and Ed Addio, who'd been working with the planning. Is that what he was involved in, planning or parks?
I believe so, yeah,
yes.
Parks.
So there was some discussion about how that went down. It was there were some very mixed reactions to your request to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were. I think I talked a little bit about this at our library panel. I don't remember. I remember some of the negativity, but I don't remember a lot of it. I know it was there, and I know that, you know, I do have flashes of memory of women standing up as part of the anti-women's lib movement, whatever her name was. And I certainly remember reading about it, why girls shouldn't play, and the law, you know, they don't want it. We don't want girls to hear that language. What if they get hit in the, you know, in the nether regions, and they won't be able to have children and things like that. But the real ugliness, I think that my parents sheltered me from quite a bit. The only ugliness that I had to deal with was perhaps from peers, you know, in school, and that not in grammar school, that didn't happen. But in junior high school, it you know, as we're becoming adolescents now, and you're dealing with older kids, there was some teasing that happened, for sure. That was hard.
Do you want to describe it?
I don't have vivid memories of specific instances. I just know that I was always Little League Jenny, especially as the case progressed, and, you know, because it went on for a couple years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have a specific instance to talk about that felt like being teased or bullied or anything like that around it. But I definitely had a sense as a child that I didn't necessarily belong in the normal groups that were happening. At that age, it's so important for most children to want to feel like they blend in and they're, you know, exactly like all of the other kids. And I know that I definitely didn't have that sense. And it probably helped shape who I am today, because I had to learn to smile and pretend like I was okay, even as all these other groups were going off to do their own thing. You know, my group was much smaller, and you know what I mean.
Yes.
You know, kids, they want to dress exactly the same. Nobody wants to stand out at that age.
And you already are quite an individual from a very young age.
Yes. So it probably really did shape who I, you know, who I became later in life, in a very positive way, I would say.
Uh-huh. So how about the boys that you played baseball with, even when you weren't playing, you know, when you weren't allowed, just mm-hmm. before you were allowed to play legally, but the mm-hmm. boys you played with on the field, did anybody ever say anything to you?
Not at all. I mean, there was I don't think that the boys cared, especially in Little League age. I think that any animosity they might have felt was really them echoing the sentiments of their parents. Before Little League happened, if I would play in pickup games, I could go to Boyle Park and join an all-boys pickup game, no problem. And they didn't care, mm-hmm. you know, as long as I was as good as they were and playing as and trying as hard and playing as hard, it was fine. So I didn't feel it from the kids. And certainly my own teammates, once I did play Little League, as I said at the panel discussion, some of the kids were interviewed by a newspaper, and one of the kids said, "Yeah, I thought we were going to get a crappy girl, but she's pretty good." that's all we care about up to 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
There's not so much a boy and a girl thing happening with uh-huh. kids. I think that comes a little bit later with puberty.
Uh-huh. So now, in the 2 years that ensued after you wrote this fateful letter to President Nixon, and there's all these meetings and legal issues, and you're growing up. And mm-hmm. did your interest in wanting to play, was it sustained, or did it start to waver at any time?
So after Little League, Babe Ruth, which was next then in Mill Valley, they said, "No problem, you can play. We're not going to try and keep you out." So I played Babe Ruth, which was, I guess, 13 to 15. And it was definitely a little harder. The boys were becoming a little bit stronger. And it was very easy for me to be competitive because I was a really big girl. But the boys were definitely catching up and passing me now. So it was a little bit harder. It actually wasn't as enjoyable for me. I played 1 year of Babe Ruth, and then I started playing softball with the girls. The girls and young women that were still playing at that age were more competitive, and they were better players like I was.
So what happened? Tell me legally what happened with the case. It goes to court, and tell me about the ruling and the ramifications and how things changed after that.
Yeah, so we had gone to we had gone to city council meetings. We had been to Parks and Rec meetings. It had been no. In my mind, the infamous story now with Mayor Gene Barnard. The city council, one of our last council meetings, was a split. I think it was 3-3. So the deciding vote went to the first female mayor of Mill Valley, and she actually voted against it. Against me and against girls playing. And she said, basically her reasoning was viva la difference. And I remember actually being pretty heartbroken and pretty shocked by that even as a kid. So after that, NOW had gotten an ACLU lawyer, Rico Hervich, to legally represent the case. And he had been working on his side of that throughout this whole process, and he'd been with us at the council meetings. So he ended up going, and it ended up in Superior Court in Marin County, just as the Little League season was starting in what would have been my final year of eligibility. And he ended up in Superior Court, and the judge ruled in our favor, saying that this is discrimination, and it goes against Title IX. Either Little League lets girls play, or Little League cannot use public facilities anymore. Obviously, Little League, Boyle Park is a public park. So that ruling happened. Meanwhile, there had been about four or five of us spread across the United States that were fighting at the same time. And I had heard that it almost bankrupt Little League fighting all these cases. So they had decided to take one to Supreme Court. So they took it, they chose to go to New Jersey Supreme Court with that case. So they were just prepping for that case and getting ready to go to trial with that when our Superior Court judge ruled in my favor. So armed with a court order, literally, and a bunch of cameras following behind, I showed up at the first practice. I was assigned to a team, and I showed up at the first practice, court order in hand, and played my one and only season of Little League.
Wow. Armed with cameras too, showing up.
Yeah, but I shouldn't say armed. I should probably say followed by.
Yes. Just marking the moment.
Yes.
Do you have that footage?
There is footage that exists, and I have all the newspaper clippings. I have a whole scrapbook of my mom. My mom was fabulous. She saved everything. So I have a scrapbook now of all of the clippings throughout the whole period.
I hope and you I, can share I, those with us.
I would love to.
Yeah, just scan them if you can, and we can include that with the information.
Okay.
So now you're in your final year. You're just getting under the wire for your the final season that you can play. And tell me about it. How did it go?
I loved it. I was so happy. And I remember when we were, I got up to do batting practice, that first practice, and I just kept belting it over everybody's head. Full disclosure, when you don't try out for Little League, you automatically get put on a minor league team.
Mm-hmm.
I was not allowed to play before tryouts. So even though I was, a lot bigger than all of the boys and probably a year or two older than most of them, I was put on a minor league team.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up leading the league in home runs that year, which made me feel very happy and vindicated. But my coach during that first practice, when I kept hitting it over everybody's head, they said to him, one of the reporters asked him what position I would be playing. And he said, right now it looks like hitter.
Who was your coach? Do you recall his name?
Yeah, Ned Mullins.
Ned Mullins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember any of your teammates?
I don't remember my teammates.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yes.
So there you had it. Did you at any time in your challenge, in your fight to play, think you wouldn't be able to, or had you just set your mind to it and figured it was going to happen one way or the other?
I'll be honest with you. After I wrote the letter to President Nixon and didn't hear back a week later, I probably thought, what else can I do? I've taken it as high as I can. I've written the President of the United States. Nobody's listening to me. So I probably resolved myself to the fact that I wouldn't play then. And when I got the letter back months later, from that point on, I think that I believed that I would get to play.
Did you ever hear from Nixon again after you were allowed to play?
No, he was busy. He, there was this whole thing called Watergate. So he was a little busy. He never came to one of my games.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, his loss.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Looking back on this time, were there any parents that came up to you to discuss things, show their support or their lack of support? Did you feel that you were, I guess what I'm asking is, did you, in your child world, did you feel separated from that goings on of the adults and sort of insulated by the child experience, or was that line crossed because of your challenge?
I don't feel like the line was crossed for me. I feel like I was insulated. I know that to hear Lee Hunt speak and to hear my mother speak about it, there were threatening phone calls, there were threatening letters, but I feel like I was insulated from a lot of that. Certainly on opening weekend, the first game, opening day of that Little League season that I played, I don't know if Boyle Park has ever seen so many people before. The cameras and the photographers and the parents and the jeering parents definitely went on the opposing side's bench area and that side of the field, and they let their feelings be known. There was a lot of screaming. There was a lot of yelling. That was my worst game that I ever played that season. It was pretty tough.
It affected you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I walked twice and struck out twice.
Jenny, that's a lot of pressure on a kid.
Yeah.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah, you either run and you hide and you don't want to deal with it, or you get really thick skin. And, it prepares you to, I really do, that whole experience, I think, shaped me to be as successful as I feel like I've been able to be in the rest of my life. I'm very good at hiding, that fear and that insecurity.
Mm-hmm. So that year that you were allowed to play, were other girls playing as well?
No. The ruling that came down from Superior Court was, here is the ruling moving forward. Since the season had technically started, though opening day hadn't happened, I was the only girl that was allowed to play in that year. I think it was 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And that same year, Supreme Court in New Jersey made the ruling for the entire country at the Supreme Court level saying, no, girls are going to be allowed to play. So the year I was the only girl to play that year in the United States, and the following year it was opened up to all girls.
And do you happen to know how many girls? No?
No, I do not have the stats on that.
Jenny, you have been immortalized in Boyle Park. You were there what month was it? A few months ago, on opening day.
Yeah, March, I think.
Yeah. And there was a lot of support for you that day. I saw a photograph of you and many, many girls in their baseball garb.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
It's, you know, after we talked a little bit about not wanting to be so different when you're a kid. And certainly junior high school and my time at Tam High was like that. I just, I felt like I had this notoriety in Mill Valley that just it made me very different. It was very hard. And I never regretted the experience. I loved playing baseball, but I wish that everybody would just forget about it now. So we moved to Fairfax about halfway through high school for me, and I finished up at Drake. And I was very glad to make the switch at that point so that I could go back into, you know, not having this this Little League notoriety over my head. But going back to Boyle Park and seeing that made me feel so incredibly proud and so loved. That seems like kind of a strong word, but so loved and appreciated. It really warmed my heart. It was one of the highlights of my life for sure.
And what I'm talking about for those that are listening, immortalized, is there's now a plaque in your honor at Boyle Park. You are.
It's a whole boulder, Deborah.
It's a whole big boulder.
That's right.
Has your name and your experience on it. And there were how many did they, I wasn't there that day, sadly. But I was trying to remember from the article how many girls are playing baseball and Little League in Mill Valley. Do you recall from that day?
I think most of the girls were in that photo that you probably saw. So mm-hmm. I would say maybe 40, 50, something like that. And it's great. You know, I have a son, Wyatt, and he's almost 17. But when he was young, from the time he was eligible for T-ball, we were playing baseball in Little League. And I've coached his team a couple of times, and the girls drop off as they get a little bit older, but it was a lot of fun coaching for him and having the girls on the team and kind of knowing that, you know, I played maybe a small part in that, though I'm sure somebody else would have done it by now if I hadn't done it back then.
How's it coming back to Mill Valley after all these years?
It's actually really nice, and Mill Valley is still such a great town. I know I was talking with somebody while I was up there for opening day in the parade, and they were saying how, you know, how it's growing so much and, you know, it's not the same. And for me coming, I live in Los Angeles now, so for me coming up, it is the same. You know, progress has happened in places that I've lived since then much, much more quickly than it has in Mill Valley. Mill Valley retains its charm to me and its quaintness and its people. You know, the people who live there, yourself included, are just so wonderful and so warm and so so gracious.
On to your adult life. So you go from Fairfax. Tell me a little bit of what happened as you continued on in your life, so we can not just have the story from long ago, but update everybody to how your life has been since then. And also, if you can include, well, let me ask that this part after you talk a little bit about your life.
Okay, so we moved up to Fairfax, and I went to Drake, as I said. I went there for, I guess, about a year and a half. I graduated a little bit early and tried to figure out what I wanted to do. I thought for a moment maybe I'd be a forest ranger, so I went to Humboldt State and realized that I really didn't want to be doing that, so I came back to Fairfax for a little bit. And ended up, I was working in I just gotten a job in a restaurant, kind of as a short order cook in Tiburon. And my stepdad, Steve, had just gotten hired by George Lucas. They were moving ILM, which is his visual effects division that had done Star Wars. They were getting ready. They were doing Empire Strikes Back, and they were setting up in San Rafael. And they had just, you know, they were just starting construction out at Skywalker Ranch. So he was running the general services department at that time, which included janitorial. And over the summer in 1980, one of his janitors had twisted his ankle and he needed somebody to fill in for 6 weeks. So since it was only 6 weeks, it wasn't nepotism. And they brought me in to be a janitor. And in that 6 week period, Steve was actually brought on to go out and be the manager of the ranch, and kind of oversee that and develop the vineyards and things like that. So once he left, I was such a good janitor that they kept me on. So my career started at 18. My film career started at 18 as a janitor for George Lucas at ILM during Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, it's been a fun ride since then.
Seems that the cameras follow you wherever you go.
Well, they weren't following me then. I was following the camera at that point. I'm a behind-the-scenes person.
They're in, out and about. So
yes.
Continue. So
I worked there for 8 years, ending my ILM journey as a coordinator at ILM, doing films. I worked on one of the Cocoon movies and Roger Rabbit, and it was a great time up there, Witches of Eastwick. But I was always going to be little Jenny the janitor, who's now a coordinator. Isn't that cute? So I felt like I needed to go and spread my wings. So I moved to L.A. and started working at visual effects companies in L.A. And I think that I've worked at most every visual effects company that's ever been in existence. And I need to say that's not because I can't hold a job. It's more the nature of the work. It's a very nomadic kind of business.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So a coordinator, how do you go from being a janitor to a coordinator? And what is a coordinator? What does that mean?
So you go from, my trajectory was nighttime coordinator to daytime. I mean, nighttime janitor to daytime janitor, to mailroom, to shipping and receiving, to production assistant at ILM, and then to coordinator. So it's basically making sure that everybody's getting to screenings that they need to be at, and making sure that the work, you know, a single visual effects shot might have five different departments back then who need to touch it. So it's making sure that everything's flowing the way that it needs to flow to get it done on time, making sure everything gets done on time and that sort of thing.
And how do you segue into special effects from there? Was that your particular interest?
Well, what I liked about it was the chaos management portion of it. I wasn't one of those kids who, you know, saw a Ray Harryhausen movie when I was young and thought, wow, that's what I want to do. But when I became a PA and then a coordinator, just the energy that's in visual effects and filmmaking in general, I learned that I'm actually really good at chaos management. I'm really good at kind of setting up a box for everybody to play in, and then managing the frenetic energy that's going on inside of that box.
You mentioned that your early experiences where you stay calm and carry on, those skills you honed going through the legal action and so on helped you. And I am assuming that you mean that in this case as well. It was preparation for being calm in the middle of chaos.
Yeah.
Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, and I think the calmness, you know, I don't know that I started out calm in the middle of the chaos, but it definitely came over time. I love actually just being able to take a hodgepodge of stuff and trying to make sense of it and bring organization to everybody and let them do their creative jobs.
So how about a list of some of the films you've worked on?
Oh, it's a long list. Some of the most recently, I did the TED films. I spent 11 years at Sony as executive vice president of production for the visual effects and animation division. And over there, we did a lot of tentpole films. We did the first three Spider-Man movies, and we did a couple of the Matrix movies. We did some groundbreaking stuff in Stuart Little, and also we were one of the first places to successfully manage visual effects and animation. So we opened an animation division and did Surf's Up and Open Season. It's a long list of films. I probably have touched 30 to 50 films over the course of my career.
And we being your company?
I'm sorry, did I not say I meant I.
Okay.
Certainly, probably a good 20, 25 while I was at Sony, mm-hmm. and then probably another 20 or 25 outside of Sony that I've worked on in the capacity of either running production at a facility or as a visual effects producer for the show specifically.
And how about, but now you are semi-retired?
Yeah, I would call myself that. I had a company for the last 8 years. that was doing visual effects, kind of management, I would call it. We were just a production entity that could manage visual effects for shows. And we developed some software in there somewhere, and I sold some of that IP to Technicolor recently, and doing consulting for them. And my hope is that when Wyatt graduates next year from high school and goes off to college, that I can be done or be almost done.
And your company's name is?
It's the Creative Cartel.
Creative Cartel.
Mm-hmm.
When you look back, starting from when you were a kid to everything that you've become today, do you ever think you could have done things differently? Do you ever wish things had worked out differently?
I was actually thinking about that recently, and absolutely not. You know, every door, when any door closes, another one opens. And so I think by having regrets and wishing I'd done things differently or that things had turned out differently would be to say that I'm not happy with where my life is today. And I'm extremely happy with where my life is today. I have a wonderful wife now. We've been together for 10 years, and I have a beautiful son who's sweet and compassionate and funny and smart. I have a nice house, a nice life. I've had a great career. I don't know how I could possibly have any regrets.
And your wife's name is?
Her name is Lori.
Lori, yes,
yes.
A delightful woman. She was there for your presentation for the panel discussion.
Yeah. Any regrets that I might have had were before I met Lori, and you know, if I had done things differently at that point, it might not have taken me to, you know, to that relationship, which has been the most amazing relationship of my life.
What would you say to somebody who might be facing some kid? Let's imagine you were talking to your younger self.
Mm-hmm.
When you were going through it, what tips could you offer? What words of support? What would you say to that younger person if you could, to help you get through it?
I think it would be to know because because of the whole Little League experience and getting that thick skin, and you know, my mom was very young. And then when my brother was born, when I was 12, I feel like I was really kind of, and I was a bit of a wild teenager, I will admit. And I was left a bit on my own, I feel. So there was a lot of insecurity that I developed walls to protect myself from having to feel. And I would try and love myself a little bit more when I was younger. And I would try and tell myself to love myself a little bit more, not be so worried about being vulnerable with people,
mm-hmm.
and maybe not try to not feel those feelings so much.
Do you think your sexual identity was played a large part in your?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I always, you know, I was born this way. But you know, it was in the '70s, and it wasn't as easy to come out then. And so there was, on top of the stigma that I might have had from doing the Little League, there was also, I don't feel the same as everybody else inside for reasons I can't even talk about. Maybe I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why don't I want to play horsies in the field? I don't. I want to play French Connection with my friend Wendy, who's a lesbian today too. Mm-hmm. You know, so you feel different and you don't know why at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Until you start understanding sexuality and those feelings become, you know, something a little more tangible.
In your glamorous career in the film business.
So glamorous.
Does anybody know about, had it ever come up? Did anybody make the association about you are the famous Jenny Foley who changed baseball as a child?
I don't talk about it that much. I mean, I will tell people if it comes up. It's certainly not something I hide by any means, but I also don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be a braggart. But it definitely people know, and not often, but when somebody realizes it or hears it, they'll be like, oh my God, I didn't know that was you. I remember when that was happening, and
mm-hmm.
that's so neat. My daughter plays and that sort of thing.
How about your son? What's your son say about the whole thing? The experience when, cause he's now old enough, he's been exposed. He was there for your plaque unveiling.
Yes, he was.
He was there for opening day. I'm sorry he couldn't come to the first Wednesday presentation.
that pesky junior year of high school gets in the way of things for him. I know that he's proud, and certainly when he was young, I know that he was proud, and I know that he was proud opening weekend, because he's a teenager now. He's not very warm and cuddly. He's very independent, and everything I do is stupid. When we were walking after he rode in the parade, which he said he wasn't going to do, and he did that, rode in the truck with us, the mayor and Wyatt and I, and I think the woman, I forget her name, who heads Parks and Rec now. And then afterwards, we were standing, and people were talking to me, and reporters were talking to me, and he was standing there with his arm around me.
Mm.
So I know he's proud. I never get his arm around me anymore. So I knew that he wanted to be seen as, you know, with me. So it was very sweet.
That's golden for a mother. Yes, that's yes, good. Yes.
Yeah, it's 17. It's very golden.
Did you ever have the opportunity to talk with your stepfather and your mother later in life to kind of reminisce and discuss the event?
Which event? You mean in general?
The whole legal event with the Little League.
Yeah, and not so much my stepdad, but with my mom. Yeah, you know, we've talked about it before, and she's the one who has told me about the calls and the emails, the letters and things like that that were, you know, a little bit scary, and that she's told me that she was actually fearful during that time. So we've talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And she, of course, is very proud. I saved her a copy of the Marin IJ that had the girls and I throwing our hats up.
Oh, she's still around. That's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She lives, she's close by.
She is in LA.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Well, this has been quite a story. It really is. It's been so wonderful to actually get your perspective. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you wish we could include in this discussion?
Deborah, I think you were thorough and covered it all with your questions.
Here to help.
Mm-hmm. Phone going off. Well, let me think if I can think of one last thought. I guess it's about fate.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that it's an interesting discussion, I think, about this, of the events that happen to people and how, why that person and why this person. And the thing I'm going to make a comment and I'd love your opinion about is that it seems to me in hearing your story that you just had a passion for something,
mm-hmm.
that you loved something and you loved to play and you wanted to play. And that passion propelled you to unknown territories.
Yes.
So in the conclusion of this interview, I would say that if I was to add one thing to your introduction, I would describe you as a passionate person.
I am a passionate person. When I latch on to something, for better or for worse, it's like trying to pry. Getting it away from me is like trying to pry it from my cold, dead hands.
Passion is a powerful force.
It is, for good and for evil.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Jenny, I think that just about does it. Although, before this interview, I asked if we might be able to add a little musical come on. Are we going to be able to do it?
Okay, I'll do it.
Okay, we're going to do it, because if not now, when, right?
I'll start it in my tune, my key, okay?
Okay, and I'm going to sing really loud, all right?
Okay, good. So you'll drown me out?
Okay, you start. Right.
Take
me out to the ball game.
Take
me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks.
I don't care if I ever get back.
Let me root for the home team.
If they don't win, it's a shame.
For it's 1, 2, 2.
3 strikes, you're out at the
old ball game.
Wow, we suck. We suck.
We may not have hit that one out of the park, but you sure hit a lot of other ones out of the park.
That felt like a strikeout to me.
Hey, a song is a song.
But at least we went down swinging.
Perfect.
All right.
Thanks, Jenny.
Okay, Deborah.